Welcome to Under the Sun on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. Under the Sun tells the stories of South Florida, on the air and online.
It's been 6 months since Haiti's devastating earthquake. No place in the U.S. has been more affected by this disaster than South Florida, home to the largest Haitian population in the country.
Today, we're devoting the full hour to how the earthquake in Haiti has changed life here in South Florida. For this special, we looked for stories about schools, hospitals, faith,
immigration policy, language, and music.
These are some of the voices you'll hear over the next hour.
Courage! I can't sleep, I can't eat good, then I pray.
I spent 4 days under the concrete blocks. The concrete blocks fell on my head.
And Miss St. Louis cannot tell you that. Hello, can't tell you that.
Haitians have a way of expressing themselves. They have to cry loudly. Pain has become part of our essence.
Coming up, Haitians are granted an immigration status they've wanted for ages, but it doesn't solve everything.
And a linguist's take on the signature South Florida slip-up of saying hurricane and meaning earthquake.
After the earthquake hit Haiti on January 12th, there was immediately so much media coverage of the disaster.
But one thing that the media coverage couldn't get at was the information that Haitian Americans wanted to know most, which was the status of their loved ones.
It was about a week later when that information started coming in, and that's when Under the Sun's Ruth Morris reported this story.
God is good. Tout moun k ap soufri a meme matin, courage!
The popular Haitian-American DJ of WLQY, Piment Bouc, tells listeners to keep up their courage. His name means hot pepper in Creole. Redouble your strength, he says. Help is on the way. Piment has 14 reporters in Haiti and thousands of listeners in South Florida. He broadcasts from a studio on Biscayne Boulevard. When the earthquake hit and communications went down, Piment turned up the volume.
On faut passer dans téléphone, on faut communiquer, on faut parler. Radio Peuple International, auditeur, bonjour. Allez-y la madame, one on.
He opened the airwaves to callers with any snippet of news from back home. And when he talked to his reporters, he told them to pass their phones to the people around them so they could tell loved ones how they were doing.
They come, they talk. Someone say, hey, mom, I'm Joseph. I'm not dead. Oh, my wife dead, children dead, some family dead, but I'm alive. Somebody cry because they don't have no place to live in. And also me for myself. When I watch the TV, I see what is going on. I say, oh, Lord.
Piment's program was featured all over the web. The internet, Facebook, Twitter, they've all helped raise money for relief. But they've also been a lifeline.
Facebook, what a wonderful medium.
Rosalind Philippe runs the Haiti Chérie Heritage Foundation in Miami. As she heard about people who needed to be rescued, she turned to Facebook to get the word out.
All that we're doing is copying it, reposting it, who's hurt, who's still under the rubble. And on Facebook, I found a gentleman who apparently had an amateur radio and he wanted to help. And what we've done is just say, please get the word out to the rescuers.
Many Haitian Americans are just now getting word from their loved ones. Ed Nelson is a social worker who was born in Haiti. When the earthquake hit, he opened his door to distraught families, but they didn't want counseling. What they wanted was an open phone line. The day after the quake, Nelson set up the Haitian Relief Information Center in Little Haiti, and Comcast installed 10 phones. Calls are free and unlimited.
Hello? C'est qui? Huh? Hello? Hello?
There's hand sanitizer on the tables and boxes of tissues. On the wall, photos of the missing, brides, men in suits, girls wearing colorful barrettes. Gracia Desile is one of the callers. Nelson has been trying to lift her spirits.
The father is my son.
Yeah.
The mother.
She came to Miami 18 years ago on a boat. She says she's already lost several sons when they were little because the water in Haiti was dirty and it made them sick.
I'm looking for Muriel Paul. I'm looking for my son, wife. I'm looking for Miguelita Paul. I'm looking for...
She has two sons in Haiti and five grandchildren. She spreads their photographs next to the phone. A chubby boy grinning in front of a synthetic white Christmas tree. A young woman in her Sunday best.
This is Gracia's daughter-in-law. Her parents kicked her out when she was a teenager, and Gracia took her in.
I take care of her. I never let her go because I don't have daughter. Children coming in your house, you have to take care of her. She called me mama. Now she got 5 children with my son. Now I don't know nothing to her. My son is very good. He loves me. He loves me so much. I love him so much.
Gracia has scrawled their phone numbers on the back of an envelope. She dials and dials. It rings, but no one picks up. The people here think that some phones are luckier than others. A woman named Maria Mazepas gets through on the first try.
She said he has 14 people inside the house. There's one victim. Everything calmed down. Everything okay.
14 family members survived. One niece died. In normal times, losing a small niece would be a major tragedy. But in this case, losing just one child in a large family passes for good news. And even when relatives are okay, they're often sleeping in the streets. No toilets, no food, no clean water. Social worker Ed Nelson's eyes are bloodshot. He says there have been bright spots since he opened the call center. One woman came looking for news about her son. He was visiting Haiti after a tour in Iraq, and she'd given him tons of gifts to take to their family.
The mother, she was completely devastated, and the person that came with her basically was carrying her. She had not been eating, she had not been sleeping since Wednesday.
As it turns out, the son was throwing a party for his family in Haiti when the earthquake hit. He was giving them their gifts in a park. That meant they were outside, not under the rubble.
And obviously that's what saved everybody. And she finally got through on the phone, and it was the son that responded. Oh, she said, thank God, and she was screaming. Immediately she got strength, and she was like a different person. So to me, this is one of the greatest stories that we live through here, a good one.
Communications are slowly getting better. Soon most families will know who survived, who was buried, who perished. According to Jacques Despinos, this will bring a new kind of suffering. He's the president of the Haitian American Leadership Coalition. He says many Haitian families are in shock right now, overwhelmed by the scale of their loss.
It's like somebody's drunk, who's drugging. When the drugs is out of your system, you're really going to have to face reality. I think we're going to have to face reality tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to say, oh, God, is it true what's happened to me? Is it true I lost all my kids? Is it true? Is it true? Is it true? I don't believe it.
Back at the call center, Gracia suddenly gets through.
Hello, Mike? Hello? Hello?
She started hearing connection and then she lost it.
Before she can hear anyone, the line goes dead. People around her tell her, keep trying.
Keep trying.
For Under the Sun, I'm Ruth Morris.
A couple of days after Ruth interviewed Gracia Desolé, Gracia got a phone call at 4 in the morning that both of her sons and all 5 grandchildren were actually okay.
Wow. A lot of leaders in the Haitian American community were simultaneously helping their community after the earthquake and dealing with their own personal losses. And you can hear on our website an interview with social worker Marlene Bastien talking about helping while you're hurting.
That's at WLRNunderthesun.org.
It's Under the Sun on WLRN. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. The government grants a special immigration status to immigrant groups whose home countries are basically in shambles. It's called temporary protected status. Most people call it TPS. And it allows undocumented immigrants to get their papers so they can live and work in the United States legally.
And not just work, they can also get a driver's license, they can get certain government benefits, and most importantly, they can come out of the shadows and live a life in the open. The problem, it only lasts for 18 months unless it's renewed.
And the government considers granting TPS to immigrant groups from countries where there's political violence or political upheaval, a natural disaster, and generally extraordinary conditions that make it unsafe to go back.
Haiti has been called overqualified for this designation.
2 years ago, there were four very destructive hurricanes and tropical storms that hit Haiti.
Which back then was called the worst humanitarian crisis on the island in more than a century. Now the earthquake has achieved what all of that couldn't.
The deadline to apply for TPS was supposed to be next week. It just got extended. But the process has not played out exactly the way immigrant advocates had hoped. Luders is hosing down the driveway in front of his pink house in North Miami. The house has a pool and a mango tree.
Oh, I do that every day.
Every day you clean the driveway?
That's because the oil from my wife's car, I don't have money to fix it. So every morning.
Without his papers, he hasn't been able to work, and he's worried about losing the house. Luders is not his real name. He asked us to call him that. He was home listening to the radio when he found out TPS had been granted to Haitians.
Do you remember what your reaction was?
Oh, my God. My reaction is like, God, thank you, God. I'm going to have my paper.
On January 15th, 2010, the Department of Homeland Security announced the designation of temporary protected status, otherwise known as TPS, for Haitian nationals who were in the United States as of the date of the earthquake.
1,300 people packed into the cafeteria at North Miami High School for an information session. After years of waiting, Haitians living in the U.S. finally had TPS, but only because so much of their home country had been destroyed. It was a bittersweet victory.
So when they told me, I have a problem with you, are you a criminal, something like that, and I say, oh my, why?
Luders has two traffic-related offenses. Two misdemeanors or one felony disqualifies potential applicants from TPS. His lawyer, Becky Sharpless, says it's not clear whether he's eligible. In April, she wrote to the federal government for clarification, but has not yet received a response.
I can't sleep. I can't eat good. Then I pray.
Luders came to the U.S. in 1981, legally. He was able to work as a cook, and for more than a decade, he says,
I used to send $300 every month to my country. Sometimes more. In the Christmas, I send more.
This is considered one of the biggest benefits of TPS, people sending money back to Haiti, up to $2 billion a year.
But if you can see my little girl over there.
Luders points to a framed picture of his daughter hanging on the wall. He wants to be here for her high school graduation next year.
I'm a friend now. I can afford to send her to college. I want to be my kid to be like, you know, something higher than me.
He's in an agonizing limbo. And his lawyer, Becky Sharpless, doesn't have any easy answers.
If they don't give me work permit, how are they going to do? They're going to send me to Haiti?
Well, that's the million-dollar question.
Yes, they're going to deport me. What are they going to do?
Well, currently, the government, if someone comes forward and applies for TPS and doesn't qualify.
Yes.
There's no protection against deportation.
What are they going to do to these people? They're going to send them to Haiti? Why they apply the law? Why they say, okay, this, you know, I don't understand.
Cheryl Little runs the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center. She says the U.S. government used to be more aggressive about deporting Haitians, but not anymore.
You know, I'm not one who has a lot of faith in our government doing the right thing when it comes to the treatment of Haitians, but I can't imagine for the life of me how our government is going to deport Haitians anytime soon. I mean, clearly the government of Haiti can't deal with folks coming back.
Welcome, spring breakers. It's tremendous.
In early March, Becky Sharpless, who runs the immigration clinic at the University of Miami's law school, led a TPS session in downtown Miami. Law students from around the country volunteered to spend spring break helping Haitians fill out the applications.
That on the I-821 or the I-765 form, which you're probably filling out, he will have a prior number, and that's the one you'll want to use.
Okay.
Bank statements, insurance, bills.
The process of applying for TPS is not simple.
Everything you can give them to prove that you was here before the 12.
One of the applicants held up a bulging pink folder. Like many Haitian TPS applicants, he asked us not to use his name.
I had to do this because it's not good to live illegal in a country like that because there's so much opportunity you're going to miss. And now I'm trying to do the right thing.
United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, known as CIS, predicted that up to 200,000 Haitians living in the U.S. could apply for TPS. So far, just over a quarter of that number has applied.
We've been disappointed by the low number of applicants.
Again, Cheryl Little from Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center.
What we were hoping was going to be a great time, in many ways, has been very troubling.
She says there are three reasons why. Fees, fraud.
But most importantly, fear.
In some Haitian circles, TPS has come to stand for T-Pelin Social, Creole for Little Social Trap. Some Haitians are afraid that the U.S. government will use their information to deport them. I mentioned this to Linda Swasina, the Miami District Director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. This is not what she wanted to hear.
We want to try and get the message out. Don't be afraid. This is not a trap. Other countries have gone through this without the consequences that they're fearing. And there's just such great benefits to being able to live and work legally in the United States.
CIS promised that they would be reviewing these applications with a generosity of spirit, and they're true to their word.
Immigration advocate Cheryl Little has often been a harsh critic of U.S. policy toward Haitians.
I do believe that CIS has gone out of its way to make sure that as many Haitians who are eligible for TPS come forward, apply, and are granted.
Marie Theodore, her husband and five children, live in a one-bedroom apartment in North Miami. In March, they paid almost $3,000 to apply for temporary protected status. The good news came 6 weeks later.
I said, thanks, glory to God. I said, thank you, God.
She says TPS has given her family a sense of pride. Their son, Wigginson, graduated from North Miami Beach High School in June.
My dream is I want to study criminal justice and then be a police officer.
Wigginson's brother hopes he can become a doctor someday. His sister would like to become a nurse, and their parents are studying English. TPS will expire a year from now, unless the government extends it.
Do you think about what happens after the 18 months?
I was thinking that after the TPS, they would automatically give us residency.
This is one of many misconceptions about TPS. It's not a permanent solution. It only buys time. By no means has getting TPS made life easy for the Theodores. Now they can get driver's licenses, but they can't afford a car. Four of the five kids are old enough to work, but they can't find jobs. Only their mom, Marie, works part-time, mornings at a Haitian restaurant that she says is never busy. The one thing the Theodore family has now that they didn't have much of before is hope. TPS is like a pause button. For some immigrant groups, Hondurans and Nicaraguans, it's been renewed for the past decade. For others, Bosnians and Rwandans, TPS has come and gone. But either way, immigrant advocates and the federal government agree. All eligible Haitians should apply. Cheryl Little.
Once the application period ends, if you don't have this relief, once our government decides that they're going to start deporting people, you can get that knock on the door, and the next thing you know, you're in detention and you're back in Haiti.
If eligible Haitians don't apply for TPS, the chance to stop looking over their shoulders, to work here legally, to send money home, all of that could be gone. It's Under the Sun on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. So if you want to get a sense of how complicated TPS can be, we have an illustrated schematic on our website, WLRNunderthesun.org.
Before January, when you thought about natural disasters in Haiti, you thought about hurricanes, not earthquakes.
The last earthquake in Haiti was in 1887, 123 years ago.
Still, in Haiti, where they speak French and Creole, there are lots of different ways to say earthquake. Tremblement and tremblement de terre, which means shaking of the earth. Te glissé, which means slippery earth.
And now a new word, gudu gudu, which means to gurgle. I talked about the language of natural disasters with a professor of linguistics at FIU. So I'm joined by Ferial Yavash. Dr. Yavash, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So to get started, we wanted to play you a little piece of tape, a recording of an interaction that we had in the studios at WLRN. This is going to be a show about personal stories of the impact of the hurricane on people in our community.
Earthquake.
That happens all the time.
All the time.
Yep, I do it all the time.
Everybody does it. It's amazing.
Joining me now from Washington is Haiti's ambassador to the United States, Raymond L.C. Joseph. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a little more than 50 hours now since the hurricane, earthquake hit.
Just before the hurricane, just before the earthquake, we had put 20 fishing villages into Haiti.
When the hurricane and when the earthquake hit, Comcast had donated telephones so the Haitians could call their families to check on how the recovery was and if everyone was okay.
And I've repeated it over and over again. In the height of that hurricane, earthquake, all of the attention was there, focused finally on Haiti.
What did you just hear happen?
Well, I heard the word hurricane used in reference to earthquake. And given the context where we are, that kind of a slip may be more than just a slip. That kind of a slip is an easy one because the end result of hurricanes and earthquakes are pretty much the same, meaning they're both huge turmoils and disasters.
You know, there's the term in psychology called availability, mm-hmm. the idea that when you're trying to describe something, you use the language or example that is most on the top of the head.
Right, right. Our frames, because we live in South Florida, our frame of disaster is very much associated with hurricanes. So cognitively, the hurricane frame to talk about disaster probably is triggered much more here than somewhere else where hurricanes are not part of the reality.
Do you think that a mother in Oklahoma would say that her child's room looks like a tornado hit and that a mother in Japan would say this looks like a cyclone hit?
I love that. I would imagine that they would refer to their own frames where Oklahoma, with its tornadoes and cyclones or typhoons in the Far East. Let's take a hurricane in Spanish. Actually, English borrowed the word hurricane from Spanish, right? Huracán. It's a fact that, for example, in Spanish and Portuguese, the word for hurricane is regularly extended to refer to a person, an individual who is like a hurricane. The person is likened to the event itself. Language is a very complex phenomenon. Language is structure, but language is also a tool for communication. Language is also the representation of reality as we perceive it. So it's very much connected to the outer world and that whatever that reality is, so to culture, to the society we're in. And it's a cognitive function of the mankind.
We're talking about these as slips, as something that kind of happens and people pay no mind and they just move on. But in fact, you would suggest that they actually have larger implications about language and how we use language.
Well, such slips eventually could lead to semantic widening, we would say, the change in the meaning of the words. For example, if this continues, becomes a trend, eventually the word hurricane would mean hurricane plus disaster, period.
So how long a time frame are we talking about?
Well, it will take 40 years, 50 years maybe.
Could you give an example of semantic widening?
Okay, sure. Bead. The beads on a string, right? Bead meant prayer, but prayer together with rosary bead. So with time, the word bead widened to include rosary bead. And then with time, it widened further, and we know what bead means today. It doesn't mean prayer. It doesn't mean rosary bead. It's just bead.
Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That interview is produced by Under the Sun's Sammy Mack. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. It occurs to me that this slip-up happens in Haiti, too.
We didn't receive support to fight the hurricane. We received support after that. The earthquake, excuse me.
That was Jean-Max Bellerive, the prime minister of Haiti.
It actually cuts both ways. For the last 6 months, we've been thinking so much about the earthquake in Haiti that the other day I was talking about Katrina, and I actually referred to it as the earthquake in New Orleans.
I have become incapable of saying the word earthquake without first checking myself to see if I'm talking about the right kind of natural disaster.
Yeah, it's really interesting how interchangeable they've become in our minds.
Well, if you want to learn a little bit more about that and how word meanings change over time, you can listen to an excerpt of my interview with Dr. Yavash at WLRNunderthesun.org.
Also on our website, there's a photo essay of the earthquake by the Miami Herald's Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer Patrick Farrell. Patrick tells us the stories behind his pictures, and he also gives us his account of arriving in Haiti right after the earthquake. That's WLRNunderthesun.org.
You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Search for WLRN Under the Sun. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
So that is Romel Joseph, the Haitian violinist. Remind me what the name of that song is?
My Favorite Things from The Sound of Music.
Of course. So Romel Joseph was trained in Juilliard, and he went back to Haiti, his homeland, to start a music school. And it was that music school that fell on him during the earthquake and had him trapped.
He says that while he was waiting to be rescued, he survived by playing all the concertos he knew in his head.
Joseph was treated at Jackson Memorial Hospital for crushed legs and two severe fractures in his left hand, and his doctors said that he might never play the violin again.
What you're hearing now is Romel playing from Jackson Memorial Hospital. It was the first time since the earthquake that he played for anyone other than his doctors. It was recorded by the Miami Herald's Hannah Sampson.
Today we're devoting the hour to the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti.
All of the music in this show has a connection to Haiti. We're featuring some Creole and French hymns that we recorded ourselves, as well as music played by Haitian musicians. There's actually been a fair amount of music written in response to the earthquake, and on our website there's a story by Under the Sun's Ruth Morris about some of that music, including songs by South Florida artists.
That's WLRNunderthesun.org.
You're listening to Under the Sun on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch.
Coming up after the break, an exploration of music and faith through the voices of doctors, nurses, and a Catholic priest.
The bond formed between a doctor and a 9-year-old earthquake survivor.
And the friendship between two Haitian high school students in Lauderdale Lakes.
It's Under the Sun. We'll be back in a minute. We're back with Under the Sun on WLRN. We're telling the stories of South Florida. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. It's been 6 months since Haiti was hit by a devastating earthquake. And today we're looking at the impact of that earthquake on life here in South Florida, where we have the largest Haitian population in the country. The Notre Dame de Haiti Catholic Church is in the Little Haiti neighborhood in Miami. And after the earthquake in January, parishioners started greeting each other with the phrase, "Who did you lose?"
Reverend Reginald Jean-Marie calls his church the living room of the Haitian American community.
Yeah, when I learned from the journalist from Channel 7 that there was an earthquake in Haiti, I went directly to the church. I opened the doors of the church for people to come and pray because Notre Dame is the living room of the Haitian community. They were crying, they were leaning on each other. Haitians have a way of expressing themselves. They have to cry loudly. Pain has become part of our essence. They will hold upon the stomach, will, you know, just throw themselves on the ground to find strength.
Mm-hmm.
What was visible is that there was already a sense of solidarity. The stronger tried to console the other ones. Well, since the earthquake, we have seen a great increase in terms of presence in our communities. Faith becomes stronger in moments of trials and tribulations. The 9 o'clock mass at Notre Dame on Sunday, I was looking around, and until yesterday I had to tell the manager, we got to go buy more chairs so that I can put chairs outside and place some speakers outside. And on any given mass, we will have about 1,300 people coming to church at Notre Dame. We're singing. They sing songs of hope, the songs of surrendering, the songs of pity, of crying for help, of forgiveness. During that time, those are the songs that dominate our liturgy, our prayers. When we sing, we feel we are not just in existence, but we are living. If you disconnect Haitian from music, you can proclaim the deaf. When they are singing, this is a way of taking the pain out, you know? That's how we express our pain in Haiti. We express it out loud. As St. Augustine said, you know, to sing is to pray twice, you know? And for us, when we are singing, we are praying. We are praying.
That piece was produced by Under the Sun's Ruth Morris and Kenny Malone.
That was a Creole hymn called Mwen Pap Sablie, which means I will never forget what the Lord has done for me. It was sung by a choir at the Notre Dame d'Haïti Catholic Church. It's one of five choirs there, which tells you something about how important music is at the church.
Ruth was in Haiti right after the earthquake, and she recorded a song at a tent camp that she played for Reverend Jean-Marie. You can hear him talk about that song at WLRNunderthesun.org.
It's Under the Sun on WLRN. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. A few weeks after the earthquake hit, I met Lynn Neifeld. She's the head of physical therapy at Jackson Memorial Hospital. And she told me about this extraordinary video that a doctor had taken while he was in Haiti. It took us a while, but we finally tracked down that video.
We can't show you the video because of patient privacy issues, and also because this is radio. But we can play you the audio.
Okay, so to set this up, we spoke to four different medical staff who were all there for the moment.
They are David Pitcher.
I'm an orthopedic oncologic surgeon at the University of Miami.
John McDonald.
I am a retired thoracic vascular surgeon from Broward County.
Carmen Maria Romero.
I'm a physical therapist. I've been volunteering in Haiti for 10 years.
And David Chan, who took the video.
I'm an orthopedic surgery resident at the University of Miami, Jackson Memorial Hospital.
We also added in some sound that was recorded right after the earthquake in Haiti. It's from the tarmac of the Port-au-Prince Airport and from the medical tent in Haiti.
I remember flying over Haiti and being amazed because it was actually very cloudy over the island itself, and it was getting towards sunset. The way the light hit the clouds was just so beautiful, and I can vividly remember the stark contrast between the breaking the cloud cover and going down underneath the clouds and seeing the island.
I knew it would be frustrating that I would be able to use very little of whatever talent I had, but I knew that what little talent I had was better than what they had.
I had been in the Army, and I'd done all kinds of medical triage and mass casualty, and I don't think there was anything that could have prepared any of us for something like this.
We landed at night.
We arrived into a war zone, soldiers from all different countries.
We smell all this airplane fumes.
Darkness everywhere except from generator lights around the airport.
We took an SUV to the compound.
To the tent hospital.
The tent hospital was basically comprised of four large tents.
Like huge carnival tents.
Like a small circus tent, but instead of amusement, you have literally cot to cot to cot.
Rows and rows of basic cots with patients on.
125 people, and they're all injured.
The vast majority of the wounds were crush injuries.
Crush injuries to the upper extremity, lower extremity, crush injuries to the pelvis.
Open, huge holes in the skin, legs, back.
Broken femurs, broken tibias, and they couldn't get up.
The temperature was about 90 degrees. Mosquitoes were everywhere.
The smell was all mixed in together.
It smelled like rotten flesh.
Like dead rats.
Smell of massive humans, of urine.
Urine, stool.
Unchanged bandages.
Of wounds.
The blood.
Of, I would say, dirty wounds.
No running water, no toilets, and we only had morphine tablets in our pockets that we would peel off and put in the patient's mouths like hosts.
You're feeling and you're hearing souls that have just been cracked and crushed, and it's very heavy.
How could you not be completely exhausted?
We all felt overwhelmed with worthlessness as physicians and realized that this was a catastrophe that was beyond anything we had ever even imagined. And then this happened.
It was probably between, I don't know, 9 or 10.
Probably 8:30 or 9 or maybe even 9:30.
It's in the evening. I don't know what time it was.
I was dressing wounds.
I was doing something.
I'm outside the tent.
I was in the tent. I'm not sure why I was there.
I was treating a pediatric case because we were just so short-staffed.
I'd been basically up 34 out of 36 hours.
We had amputations to do. We had debridements, so cleaning out infected wounds.
I'm kind of mentally preparing myself to go round on all the patients that were there in the tent hospital.
It all started up in the upper right side of where the tent was.
The guy just walks in with his guitar, takes this makeshift chair that we have, and he sits down, and he just starts to play his guitar.
And then you hear people around the guitar beginning to harmonize or sing something.
And then each row started to sing.
The swell gets louder,
louder
and louder and louder.
And louder and louder.
And louder. And as I open up the door, sound is triple.
Everybody.
Every Haitian.
The whole tent.
Everybody is singing these words.
It stopped everything. It stopped all of us. All the sounds of trauma just went away. It felt like it consumed all of Port-au-Prince. It was that loud.
I remember panning my camera around, and I just see this crowd of people singing and dancing in the center of the tent.
People are jumping up and down. People with head wounds.
People that couldn't get up because of their injuries, they were still singing and clapping along.
We had one little boy who, he wouldn't get up because the pain was just so debilitating, and his mother helped him stand up so he could dance on his one leg.
I, to this day, have no idea what those folks were singing.
It was obviously a chorus that they knew.
It's so hard to describe.
Something that was not familiar to me.
Something that sounds almost religious.
Until I heard the word Jesus.
And we turned to one of the translators and said, what are they singing? He said, they're singing Jesus. Thank you for loving us. It was like a knife hitting us. I mean, from what we had seen, the amputees, the kids, and when they sang that way, and the joy and the happiness that they had, it was a tipping point. Things changed after that.
It's extremely humbling to be around a people that, in the worst time of their life, have it in their hearts to give gratitude for what they have left, which is basically dust.
I was so brokenhearted myself, just so tired, so sweaty, so fly-ridden, really. And in the process of pulling themselves up, they were pulling the nurses and the doctors up, giving us a great sense of hope.
I decided at that moment that what I had witnessed was just such a beautiful example of human courage, that I would do anything in my power, in my life, to help Haiti rebuild. And so I quit my job. I left my family, which is my immediate family. I have an identical twin, two older brothers and an older sister, nephews, my mother and father. And so I am living in Haiti. I took a position with Partners in Health to support local Haitians to heal themselves. I think at that moment, they gave us the opportunity to really understand them and their pain and their strength and their belief. I don't think anybody in that room will ever be the same.
I produced that piece with Under the Sun's Kenny Malone. We had help from Sammy Mack.
Thanks to David Chan for providing us with that video, and to Miami Herald videographer Jose Iglesias, who gave us the sound from Haiti.
If you want to hear more from the medical staff about their experiences in Haiti, you can visit our website, WLRNunderthesun.org.
Now we're going to look at the bond between a surgeon from Miami Children's Hospital and a 9-year-old earthquake survivor. Here's Under the Sun's Nyla Boudou.
Exais Peterson was at his home in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, watching television when the earthquake hit.
I spent 4 days under the concrete blocks. The concrete blocks fell on my head.
His mom was outside in the street.
When I came, I couldn't find him. The house, the concrete blocks, had all fallen on him.
The 9-year-old boy was trapped for 4 days. When he was pulled from the rubble, his mom thought the workers were retrieving his body so she could bury him. But Peterson was alive. He was rushed to a tent hospital in Port-au-Prince. Chad Perlin was the first doctor on hand.
When the Marines brought him to me, his face was wrapped up with a bandage, and they thought that he had a broken jaw because he had a swollen face. And when I took the bandage off and hundreds of maggots spilled out from his face...
Chad's a pediatric plastic surgeon at Miami Children's Hospital. In the chaos following the earthquake, Chad and other Miami doctors helped set up a separate tent to treat children. But the onslaught of crushed kids made Chad question whether his medicine was even making a difference until he took off Peterson's bandages.
I thought, we are making a difference. This is why we're here. No 9-year-old boy should have to go through this and be in this condition. And of course, I thought of my own son.
Chad's son Ethan was born a year and a half ago. But in Haiti, Chad said he wasn't being a parent. He was being a doctor. Chad knew the tent hospital in Port-au-Prince didn't have the equipment to treat Peterson. So Chad put Peterson on a list of kids so injured they needed to be flown to the U.S. for treatment. Peterson's mom left her other kids with relatives. She and Peterson made it out on the next flight. Chad moved on to new patients.
And that's where I thought the story of Peterson and I ended, that I'd help get his wounds clean and get him well. And then put him on a plane.
Children were being sent to hospitals across the U.S., Orlando, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. At Miami Children's, 23 young earthquake survivors took up an entire wing on the hospital's second floor.
Good morning, Two East. This is Kathy.
So this is Two East. And before the earthquake, Two East was just a regular surgery floor. And they had kids who had their appendixes out or their tonsils or plastic surgery operations or things. And then after the earthquake, this place very quickly became really the hub of all the activity here at Miami Children's, and it really was little Haiti.
For us, you know, I think Haiti just became a face through those children.
Anya Toom is a nurse at 2 East.
We knew one child at a time, we could help them.
Chad's been a week in Haiti. His return flight landed at 5 a.m. He called his family, and then he called the hospital to check on the kids from Haiti.
I was amazed.
Peterson was in Miami. Chad says that was the first time he thought of their connection as fate.
It's just Haiti. It's just the way the things seem to work out, seeing him here and seeing his mother here. I think we were both equally surprised.
So even after Peterson arrived in the States, his mom was convinced he was going to die. She says to save her son's life, God and Dr. Perlin broke Peterson's coffin. Chad's performed 12 surgeries to rebuild the left side of Peterson's face. But the biggest challenge is for him to craft a new left ear for Peterson. It took 2 months for all the kids at 2 East to become well enough to be discharged. Peterson and his mom, along with the rest of the other families, moved to an extended stay hotel near Miami Airport. The families take up most of the second floor.
Do you like being out of the hospital?
Yeah.
Yeah? You're glad you're not there anymore, right?
The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is helping some families with their immigration status. The church group decided to move the families, including Peterson and his mom, to Arizona, where it has a refugee resettlement program. Chad and the other doctors made the case that uprooting Peterson and several other kids would slow their recovery. For now, the doctors from Miami Children's visit the hotel often, especially Chad. On this visit, Chad's brought Peterson a gift, an English Creole dictionary.
Leave.
Leave? In English. Book. Okay. So this book's for you.
Thank you.
To help with your English. You're welcome.
Even as the decision on Arizona looms, the connection between Chad and Peterson is deepening. Most Sundays, Chad and Brooke invite all the families over to their Miami Beach house for a swim. Peterson's taken to calling their 18-month-old son, Ethan, his baby. They've taken the kids on field trips to the Miami Seaquarium and most recently, Universal Studios. In this video, Peterson is talking about the highlights of his trip, as well as his newfound love for roller coasters.
My name is Peterson Exiles. I like pool. I like hotel. I like Dr. Perlin. I like Mom Children Hospital.
Roller coaster.
I like roller coaster. Okay.
In April, Chad and his father-in-law went back to Haiti to bring Peterson's family supplies and a tent. Peterson's been raised by his mom. His dad's not really in the picture. Every night, after dinner, Peterson usually calls Chad to talk.
How are you? Ça passe? How are you feeling?
Fine.
Did you learn English today?
Yes.
Did you go swimming?
Yes.
You went swimming today? So that's the gist of our conversation every night. He calls me. He calls me some days several times a day. And, you know, the nurses in the OR know that if I'm operating, they just say he's busy. And, when I get home, I call him back. And he just needs to know that I'm still around.
Chad sees himself as playing two roles in Peterson's life, as his doctor and as his friend.
We keep boundaries. So when I go over to see him to the facility where they're staying, I don't play doctor. I don't examine him. Those are the days that I'm there as a friend and as a mentor to him. But when he comes to the office and I have my white coat on, he knows that he's going to get examined and I'm going to be his doctor.
I ask Chad whether being Peterson's friend has played a role in his desire for Peterson to stay here in Miami. He didn't want to be recorded talking about it because he didn't want anything he said to affect the bishop's decision.
And I think for him, part of the process of healing from everything he saw in Haiti was caring for the children at Miami Children's.
That's Brooke, Chad's wife. She was worried about how Chad would handle the emotional stress of Haiti. Then Peterson entered their lives.
I think that really helped him cope with it, and knowing that, you know, he was still helping Haiti.
In late June, the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops made their decision. Most of the families were relocated. Only 4 got to stay. Peterson and his mom were one of them.
There's just something incredibly special about that little boy, and he represents to me, because of all of his circumstances and our emotional state as a team when he came in, to see this little boy, and he just represents Haiti. He represents his whole country, the whole future of the country.
For now, Peterson's future is in Miami. He's starting to learn English. He's scheduled to have a few more surgeries. In the fall, he starts school. For Under the Sun, I'm Nyla Boodoo.
You can see a video of Peterson and some of the other kids from 2 East on a visit to Universal Studios in Orlando with Dr. Perlin. That's on our website, WLRNunderthesun.org. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman. This is Under the Sun on WLRN.
After the earthquake, thousands of Haitians flooded into South Florida, including 2,500 students. Those students made their way into classrooms across South Florida, including Boyd Anderson High School in Lauderdale Lakes.
At Boyd Anderson, Haitian students who were there before the earthquake started mentoring the Haitian students who arrived after the earthquake. Under the Sun, Sammy Mack and Trina Sargalski went and talked to some of those students. The school calls it the Ambassadors Program, and Trina is here to tell us more about it.
So basically, the ambassador teaches the new student where to find their classes, the rules of the school, and just all those sort of informal things that maybe only another teenager can show you. For example, what certain slang words might mean. The students we spent the most time with were James Celestine and Michelle Filko, better known as Filko.
So who came before the earthquake and who came after?
Filko arrived about 3 years ago, and James came over about 2 months after the earthquake. What we did is we asked Filko and James to take some recorders with them for a few weeks and interview each other. And what you're going to hear now is a conversation between the two friends. This is James and Filko talking about what the first day of school was like for James. And you'll hear James speaking in Creole and then Filko translating.
Can you tell us how did you feel when you were entering in your first class?
Boom.
You said he was a little bit scary because it was not really know the system, so pretty much that's it. Can you tell us what happened next? He said little by little he was getting the system, little by little he was doing better and getting better grade.
So James is speaking Creole there, but later on he starts to speak more English, right?
Yes, and Filko helped James a lot with the English, but the help was also mutual, as you'll hear in this next clip.
James, let's go!
I'm helping him in the speaking English, and he's helping me in another way. For example, I might help him in reading, he might help me in math.
Because I'm more smart in math than him, I help him all the time in the math class.
So that was James there talking in English.
Yes.
James seems to really get a kick out of the fact that he's better than Filko in math.
Yeah, actually, James is a top student at Boyd Anderson now. And according to one of his teachers, he came to the school very well prepared. It was just a matter of transferring his knowledge from one language to a new language. And from what I gathered from the boys, they seem to think that the schooling in Haiti was more rigorous. So here they talk a little bit about the differences they observe.
School year in Haiti is a big, big difference for me.
In Haiti, we don't have police in the schools. Even the student can come out of school and with the shirts outside or the pants.
And if I don't know my lesson, it will be hard for me because my director, my teachers will whoop me.
So Filko, who's the student who came from Haiti a few years ago, did Filko just say if he didn't learn his lesson in Haiti, he'd get whooped?
Yes, and according to what I understand, the teacher-student relationship in Haiti is much more formal. So even though corporal punishment in schools was outlawed in 2001, it's still a common practice. Sammy and I noticed the way James and Filko would often say, yes, ma'am, and it's much more formal. I've been a teacher for several years, and it's very rare for one of my students to address me that way.
So Trina, how did these two students get paired up?
Well, to answer that, here's a clip. It's James and Filko talking to one of their teachers, Miss St. Louis.
When you set up the ambassadors, how did you know who to put together?
I have been teaching for over 35 years. One thing that I learned in life is to study people. So when I look at the characters and the personalities, I already know who can be paired together. It was obvious that you two were buddies. From the first day that James came from Haiti, you became such a good friend for him, showing him different classes, and when I give an assignment, you are assisting him.
Okay, Miss St. Louis, In your opinion, what can a student teach another student that an adult cannot?
Well, I will say a lot of things. Like, if you're a gentleman, Phil Cole can tell you, be careful, you might get burned. You watch out with this girl, okay? And Miss St. Louis cannot tell you that. Hello, can't tell you that. When an adult is trying to teach you certain things, you say, well, you know, grown folks, they always be talking and talking and talking. But when it's your own friends that is talking to you, you tend to believe them and follow them, especially if they are doing the right thing.
I feel like we're overhearing a conversation, a private conversation that is being had in the school.
Yeah, and you were. That was recorded by James and Philco. They're arriving at a new school, but here's somebody who speaks their language and they feel like who understands them. So this ambassadors program is about more than just finding out where the cafeteria is or learning American slang. It's also about providing important emotional support. Here are James and Philco talking about how they feel about Haiti.
A lot of me is still home in Haiti.
That's James saying a lot of me is still back home in Haiti.
Because since I was in Haiti, almost all of school was my friend. And we are always joking. It was very fun in Haiti.
It's kind of sweet.
And sad.
It is sad, but James also says that he's happy here now. He's not so nervous anymore, and he feels ready to be a mentor to a new student next year.
Next year, I'm going to be in 11th grade. I think I'm ready to be an ambassador, so, like, just, like, feel cool.
You know, Sammy and I are really grateful to them because they did a great job recording the sound for this piece. And we're looking forward to sharing more voices of young people from around South Florida in a new project that Sammy and I are starting. Philco and James' classmates also recorded their voices, and you can hear some of their interviews on our website, WLRNUnderTheSun.org.
Trina Sargalski and Sammy Mack brought us the voices of Michelle Philco and James Celestine from Boyd Anderson High School in Lauderdale Lakes. I'm Alicia Zuckerman.
And I'm Dan Gretsch. You've been listening to Under the Sun on WLRN. That's it for today's show, but we are still committed to covering the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti.
So if you have an idea for us, please get in touch at WLRNUnderTheSun.org or 305-995-2204.
Under the Sun's executive producer is Peter J. Mertz. Our associate producers are Kenny Malone, Ruth Morris, and Trina Sargalski. Trina and Ruth are also our web editors.
Our assistant producer is Sammy Mack, and Brett Rothfeld is our engineer.
Special thanks to WLRN General Manager John Labonia, as well as Adrian Kennedy and Rick Lewis.
Thanks also to Julia Longoria, Dave Samayoa, Steve Malagodi, Muriel Germay, Corey Princel, Samara Freemark, and Amy O'Leary.
Our theme music is by Miami's own Spam All-Stars. You can hear them every Thursday night at Hoy Como Ayer in Little Havana.
You can see photos, hear extra audio, including music from this show, and drop us a line at WLRNUnderTheSun.org.
We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Look for WLRN Under the Sun. Under the Sun is a co-production of WLRN and ZG Public Media. I'm Dan Gretsch.
And I'm Alicia Zuckerman.